Revelations, the story of the frames.
We return to the story of the frames in 1994, after the band parted company with Island Records following the flop of Another Love Song. What followed was a crash course in the realities of the music business as they scraped together the money to record their next album. The album turned out to be Fitzcarraldo, named after the film by German director Werner Herzog, which tells the story of a man intent on building an opera house in the South American jungle. The film's most striking image, that of a man dragging a boat up a mountain while blasting Verdi at the natives, struck a chord with Glenn, who felt that getting the frames back off the ground was an equally daunting task.
I saw the film one day after rehearsing, you know, and it was pretty soon after we were dropped. And my confidence was just so shattered. I was gutted, you know, we were. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know whether this was the end of our career. You know, most bands split up after they get, you know, it's pretty normal. I don't think it's anyone can be blamed for it. But because we were buskers, there was this huge sense of the cops aren't going to stop us, you know. And if you put it in terms of the record label, it's like Big Brother isn't going to just tell us, shut us down. We can, you know, so there was this kind of sense of survival going on in us. So we just kind of kept going as a band without knowing where we were going, but we just sort of kept going. Fitzcarraldo was really important for me because when I saw the film, it just seemed to reflect the momentous amount of getting up off the ground that we had to do, you know, because we really were knocked, you know. It's like, I don't envy any musician who gets dropped. I don't envy them at all. It's a very, very difficult thing. So Fitzcarraldo was very important, and I love the word as well. I just loved it, and I loved the film. And musically, it was a step forward for us. I mean, that part in the middle where Cullum and Dave were like, da 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 da. What Cullum does is become so much a signature of what we do. You know, when we played Fitzcarraldo or something, Cullum's role in that song is the champagne bottle that hits the side of the ship. Cullum was the romance. That's what he does, you know. He outlines the size of things. This was like the best music we had written. You know, we had never, as a band, we were pushing the envelope for ourselves, you know. I mean, we look back on it now and we kind of go, yeah, it's good. But at the time, we were
a quantum leap.
Yeah, we were beyond ourselves, way beyond ourselves. And so we released Revelate before we made Fitzcarraldo. And when we made Fitzcarraldo, we put a cover on it, and we had it. And just before we released it, this major record label steamed into town and said, "We think you're great. We love you. We won't do what the last record label did. We think you're brilliant, and we'll give you total freedom to do what you want." And blah 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 blah. And basically the decision among the members of the band was we should do this.
In 1995, The Frame signed a new record deal with Trevor Horn's ZTT Records, best known for its success in the 1980s with acts like Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Seal and The Art of Noise. It wasn't the most obvious choice of record companies, and the next period was a somewhat confused one. ZTT requested that the band re-record Fitzcarraldo. Neither version quite captured the power of the live shows, although it featured some of Glenn's strongest songs, including Angel at My Table and the title track. But if the band had any doubts about where they were going, these were dispelled when one day Bob Dylan appeared in the doorway of the rehearsal room at the factory. Liking what he heard, he invited the band to open up for him in London.
From the very beginning, we have always been incredibly fortunate when it comes to meeting great people. For some reason, the energy that the band has, or whatever it is, I don't know what it is, but whatever is going on, we've always had access through total access to the people who could guide us most. And it's hard to say. I've met all my heroes through playing music. I've met Leonard Cohen, I've met Van Morrison, I've met Bob Dylan, and been in a close proximity with those lads. You know, I actually had a bit of bit of conversation, you know, where it's like, I remember, for instance, there was this one amazing scenario where Bob was playing, Bob Dylan, or should I sort of address him properly, was playing in the Point Depot. Van Morrison was backstage, and because we had hung out with Bob on the previous tour, we got passes and everything, so we went down, all excited, you know, went down to the gig, and Van Morrison came up and said, Glenn, like, you know, and he grabbed me by the arm, and he says, come and meet Bob. And I said, Van Morrison has me by the arm, and he's dragging me down a corridor full of people to meet Bob Dylan. And I'm going to myself, this is amazing. Like, how far out is this scene right here? He pulled me into the room, and Bob was standing there talking to Elvis Costello and a few other people. And he brought me right up to Bob Dylan, and he says, Bob, this is Glenn. And Glenn, and Bob said, I know Glenn. And Van was like, what?
Despite such chance encounters, the period that followed the release of Fitzcarraldo was not an easy one for the band. There followed the departures of singer Noreen, bass player Graham, and eventually drummer Binzer. Recruiting a new rhythm section of Joe Doyle and Dave Hingerty, the Frames began labouring over their third album, Dance the Devil. As Glenn recalls, there were yet more trials ahead.
We had to reinvent our breakup. I mean, that was how we felt. But Dance the Devil, it's like, I remember using the analogy, we were commissioned, like a painter, we were commissioned to go and make some paintings. And we were locked in. They locked us in the fucking room, man, and we couldn't get out. And we were, you know, and for 2 years, we had that album in us. And it was like a long pregnancy. And if we didn't have that baby soon, we were going to die. I remember just a couple of incredible conversations. There was a moment during the recording of Dance the Devil where there was a complete breakdown. We'd been in rehearsing all the songs and working them out. And we were in doing God Bless Mom. And I remember Binzer was playing like this just incredibly dramatic beat, like big beat. It was classic Frame stuff. I sounded like I was singing from the top of a mountain, you know, from a pulpit or something. It was like, Trying to you see how... It was like, you know, I was really just overly dramatic. And I remember thinking, God, man, I'm so bored with this.
At this point, the band started to question what they were doing and why.
In a moment, in the studio, and we had a huge breakdown. Like, we literally got into this huge, like, argument with each other about what the hell we were doing. And what was so good about that argument was, apart from the fact that Binzer up and left the band pretty much straight afterwards because, you know, he didn't agree with the argument, was that we can't go on making this music. We have to somehow reinvent and rethink and reorganize our thoughts on what we're doing. Because it seemed like all of us were kind of doing what we knew best. It's almost like cycling a bike that we knew well. And I remember we had this big sort of breakdown, and it caused this great dialogue. What is your favorite record, you know? What do you love about music? What do you like about being the Frames? Do you like the Frames? You know, are we a good band? And we just got into this whole new philosophy of what we're doing. And Cullum sort of... And again, this argument came up of like, why should you play the violin? Why should I just be singing and playing the guitar? You know, can I not play the drums on this song? And then we just got into this whole thing of like, let's scrap all the rules. And
scrap the rules.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Scrap the rules and get into... And so we ended up recording the rest of the album in a totally arseways way.
With internal problems and record company pressure, the recording of Dance the Devil became hard work. Glenn doesn't remember it fondly.
Literally, it was every single day. Stress, fighting
every inch.
Yeah, like every single note on that record we had to fight for. I mean, Dance the Devil was definitely the hardest thing we've ever had to do in terms of not even the album itself. I mean, some of the mixes that were being proposed, I mean, you would laugh. I mean, if you heard the ZTT initial proposed record to go out onto the streets with our name written on it, it was embarrassing, you know. And it was like, I remember just hating it. I remember just hating the whole process, hating the record by the time it came out.
Not everybody agreed with them. Dance the Devil eventually went platinum, finding the band a whole new audience. Something Happened singer and Pet Sounds presenter Tom Dunn remembers his initial reaction to the album.
I thought it was brilliant album, absolutely brilliant. And I don't know if it goes as far as to say their best album, but I had Glenn in not long after it, and I said, you know, perfect opening line is probably the best song you ever did. And he was silent for about, I'd say, 40 seconds. And then finally said, I think it's the worst song we ever did. I was just going, oh no.
And I'll just be curious to see now how you'll make it by yourself when you're walking out ahead, unaware of anything. And tomorrow as we're looking through the history books of blame, you'll be walking out ahead, not caring anyway, yeah.
Seven times removed. Nothing cuts you like the lies of a friend, so hold it in your hand, yeah. Cause you can't just switch it off.
As well as the musical upheavals, the band's business affairs were a mess. Dave Odlam.
Another unfortunate managerial kind of catastrophe with this manager that we hired in the States. And like, we paid him 10 grand to basically find out that the American label didn't want to... No, 30 grand to find out that the label didn't want to put the record out. And the last straw with ZTT was the record not coming out in America, which... You know, we from day one maintained that's the place to sell this band. It's as obvious as the nose on my face.
Glenn takes up the story.
And suddenly we're meeting this guy and he's talking, you know, and he's like, I'm going to bring you to point, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, who are you? And why are we giving you so much of our money?
You know.
And he disappeared. He just disappeared. And we, you know, and we ended up paying him all this cash. And it was like, lads, what are you doing? You know, what? Kind of, you know, of course we can't afford to be just paying these people loads of money to come in and spend 2 weeks in our company, tell us that they used to hang out with Pete Townsend, and you know, it's like, we don't care.
Yet again, the Frames were learning the value of independence. Dance the Devil showcased Dave Odlam's growing abilities as an engineer, which gave the band more control over the recording process.
So much of it was done like in either my house or in Glenn's bedroom, and then we'd just go and do these ridiculous recording sessions. And like, we used to go to one of the Sarum studios in Hook End, which is a big residential studio just an hour south of London, and super posh place. And well, I remember we were doing the Trevor version of God Bless Mom, and it was Pavement Tune, and like, we had 20 reels of multitrack for the one song. And meanwhile, like, you know, I swear to God, I couldn't buy a bag of chips at home. I did a deal with the local chippy guy that he could park his car in our driveway if he'd give us chips, you know. And like, I was making the majority of the record at home, like, under these kind of conditions. Meanwhile, we were whisked off to England, and it was like the other, you know, way of living. And it was like lavish, sumptuous meals. It's like, you know, every night, like 4 or 5 course meals. And, you know, shall we return to the studio? No, let's play a little ping pong first, you know. And it was like, the whole thing was just so bizarre. But, you know, like, whatever way it takes to make a record.
Glenn recalls another typical example of record company extravagance.
I remember one night we were taken by ZTT to a gig in Dublin, a Whelan's gig. You know, whenever they come over, it was like they made a big deal of it. They sort of, it was very glamorous, you know, sort of sense of, you know, they treat us. And they were like, we'll go for dinner. We'll go for dinner before the gig. Let's go to Gibo's restaurant in Baggot Street. None of us knew where it was, you know. We went along, and it was a really posh restaurant, apparently. And we all ordered food, and remember Dave Odlam ordered the sort of a vegetarian thing, which was like four sprigs of asparagus. That was it. Like, that was the meal. And like Trevor Horn ordered this bottle of wine for $2,000, you know. And of course, we were paying for it at the end of the day. But remember, we left the place and we all went to Burger King on the way to the gig to get, you know, to get some chips, because whatever, you know, the food that was there was just ridiculous. You know, none of us were even into it. But this is the kind of expense they would, you know, the kind of expenses they would put us through. They were posh restaurants.
Once again, a split with the record label seemed inevitable. Tensions between the band and Trevor Horn were at breaking point.
This situation's killing me. It's got me right under the phone. I don't know where I wanna be. This doesn't make
sense. Trevor's whole thing was, if you would just shut up and trust me, I'll make your record massive. And we were like, fuck it. You can't do that to us. You know, we're a band. It was never our intention. You know, Trevor was like, do you not want to sell 50? I was like, yes, of course I want to sell 50,000 copies of a record, but as long as it's good, you know, as long as I can stand beside it and go, that's my art. I mean, that was the whole thing. You have to be able to stand beside it and go, that's me. And I will represent this till the end of my life. We got out of it after a conversation, a very, very frank conversation with Trevor, which went something like, we are not going to make you any money. It was like the Alan Parker conversation. We're not playing your game, because it's not, I can't do it. I have to do this other thing. No more. It's not going to happen. You have to let us go. You're not going to make a penny out of us. And he said, fair enough. The way I'm walking, you see, I want my life to make more sense. I want my life to make amends. I want my life to make more sense.
So once more, the Frames lost their record deal. But this time, they had gained the manager they were always looking for. Glenn and the band asked Claire Ledbetter to look after the Frames' business affairs after she left her position at ZTT.
And then so we said to Claire, look, you know, what do you think? Claire was like, well, I can't stand my job, you know. I'm losing it. They're all nuts. So Claire left her job. She was the sort of record, the sort of label manager. She left her job and started managing us. And then when we were dropped and she had left her job, suddenly we found ourselves in a place where we were alone and really happy. And that's when we celebrated. The second time we were dropped, we celebrated.
Claire, the Frames' current manager, you know, she's a real believer in a band, like, makes music. They write songs, record them and play gigs. And, you know, and that's it. You know, it's not rocket science.
Next up, we'll hear how the band recorded what would become their most successful album, For the Birds.
I was thinking about your style, teaching me how to shine. About your shine.
Revelations, the story of the Frames.
Todayfm.com.
Hey, Ray,